Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. It's been 50 years since 78 men lost their lives in the Farmington mine disaster.
But he had overheard his parents talking about how dangerous the mine was, and his mother had tried to get his dad to stop, saying, you know, we can manage, you know, working at the church, we'll figure it out. But he said no, he had a son to educate.
The family of some of the victims say the miners knew there was a problem in the mine, but that didn't stop production.
Came home about 8 or a little after, and he came home and he says, come down here, I want to tell you something. He said, that mine's going to go. He said, it's so full of gas, and they have a machine covered up. He said, they're more concerned about the machine than they are the men.
We'll also hear a mine safety expert talk about how Congress reacted to the disaster, passing the 1969 federal mine safety law, also referred to as the Coal Act.
You've heard the expression through the years that all mine safety legislation is written in the blood of miners, and that's really true, that the only time we get legislation is after there's been an explosion that's killed multiple people.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On November 20th, 1968, an underground explosion ripped through a West Virginia coal mine and killed 78 miners. It's what we know as the Farmington Mine Disaster. The local community came together the Sunday before the 50th anniversary of the disaster to remember the tragedy and the men who lost their lives that day. We'll begin this episode with voices from the 50th anniversary at the memorial service of the Farmington Mine Disaster. Here's Molly Bourne.
It was a crisp, clear fall afternoon at the No. 9 Memorial Site, as hundreds gathered to remember the 78 men who died here 50 years ago. Among them was Mary Lou Bragg, who lost her husband, Harold Butt, that day. She's 91 years old now, and traveled 4 hours round trip for the event. She was huddled under a wool blanket and a pile of coats in a wheelchair, with her children at her side. She remembers coming out of the post office that morning and hearing the news.
Lady, a friend of mine that was just sitting in the car along the road, and she's Mary Lou. She says, have you heard the news on the radio? There's something about a big mine explosion somewhere. And also, I said, oh my God, no. I said, I got to get home, get the television on.
Harold Budd had put in his 2 weeks' notice at the No. 9 mine earlier that month, and he had planned to switch careers to become a postmaster.
He was a nice man. He worked hard and he to raise his family. But of course, he always had his faults, too. All men do.
Here's his son, George.
There's not a day that goes by. Sorry. Yeah, It's tough. November's a very hard month.
21 found freedom from the fires beneath the ground. It took 10 long years for others. 19 were never found in the mine. Number 9.
That's Tom Briding singing his song Farmington. Union officials placed wreaths with black ribbons near the memorial that bears the miners' names. Each victim's name was read aloud during the event. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin grew up in Farmington and lost an uncle in the explosion.
It's awful when you have so many tragedies that have to happen before necessary changes are made. But the miners have paid. They've paid with their sweat and their blood.
The state had a long history of mine disasters, including an earlier one at No. 9. But the 1968 explosion ushered in new health and safety laws for the industry and saved miners' lives. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Molly Bourne in Mannington.
Following the tragedy in Farmington in 1968, the widows of the families demanded safer working conditions and action from Congress. The disaster was one of the instrumental forces that led Congress to pass the 1969 Federal Mine Safety Law, also referred to as the Coal Act. The legislation was more comprehensive than any previous mine safety law. The Coal Act required 2 annual inspections of every surface coal mines and 4 at every underground coal mine. It also gave federal inspectors more authority to enforce mine safety by issuing fines. And while fatalities haven't stopped completely since the 1969 legislation, the number of deaths decreased dramatically. In 1968, 311 Americans lost their lives in the mines. By 1980, that number had dropped by more than half, down to 133. In 2017, there were 15.
Morning in November, year of 68. Blast blew out New Ellen, and the ground began to shake in the mine.
Over the years, we've learned more about the causes and problems that led up to this mine disaster. In 2008, author Bonnie Stewart discovered a memo that suggested a security alarm inside the mine had been disabled. The alarm should have warned miners that the mine's ventilation system wasn't working. If it had been working, the miners might not have died. Scott Finn was a West Virginia Public Broadcasting journalist at the time and reported on this story that same year.
2 hours before dawn, on November 20, 1968, explosions and fire rocketed through a coal mine near Farmington, West Virginia.
Our best estimate is that at least 70 miners are still trapped inside the mine.
That's William Poundstone, spokesman for the mine. It was the first major mine disaster to be nationally televised. Americans watched for days as anguished relatives, such as Betty Friend, held vigil at the coal company store.
Our family has great hopes that maybe God will be with us and with the other families and bring all these men out.
On the 10th day, company officials sealed the mine with the bodies of 78 men still inside. The families gathered at a church to hear the news, including Jim Matish, who was 15 at the time.
There was never such wailing and crying and screaming. It's just hard to imagine.
Just days before the explosion, Matish overheard his father, Frank, telling his mother he wanted to quit the mine.
He told us that the mine was in the worst shape that he had ever seen. I can remember hearing her tell him, well, why don't you just call? Why don't you just quit and not go? He said, well, we've got a son that we need to worry about educating.
Mine foreman Pete Shushuck worked with Frank Matish in the mine. He says safety sometimes took a back seat to production.
I told my wife that time, I said, that mine's going to blow up. There's a lot of the shady things went on back there.
After the Farmington disaster, company officials reopened the mine to recover the bodies. An electrician tried to restart a large ventilation fan and noticed the fan's safety alarm had been disabled. This was the very same fan that had stopped working shortly before the explosion. An alarm should have sounded, telling the miners to evacuate. Instead, they died. A federal investigator sent a memo about the sabotaged alarm to top officials at the U.S. Bureau of Mines. One official ordered the memo to be filed away.
When I saw that memo, I had to sit down. It explained so much about why those men died and what had happened at that mine. It just floored me.
Bonnie Stewart is a journalism professor at West Virginia University. She was researching a book about Farmington when she found the hidden memo.
Had the widows known about this memo at the time, they could have taken stronger action against the company through a more powerful lawsuit than what they filed.
Most of the widows reached a $10,000 settlement with CONSOL Energy. Stewart says we may never know why the memo was buried. She hasn't been able to find the memo's author, Larry Lane, and many of the officials involved at the time are dead. The federal government finally issued a report on Farmington more than 20 years later. The 1990 report makes no mention of the memo or that someone deliberately disabled the alarm. Jim Matish, who's now a West Virginia judge, says someone should have been held responsible.
In my opinion, it amounted to a criminal act.
Officials with the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration and with CONSOL Energy declined to comment for this story. They said the mine disaster was a part of history. But the people of Farmington still remember. Matish has trouble talking about the last time he told his father goodbye.
So long, Dad. Don't work too hard. And be careful.
After Farmington, Congress passed landmark mine safety legislation. For the first time, the federal government could fine mining companies for safety violations and even bring criminal charges against the worst offenders. Before Farmington, about 250 coal miners died every year in the United States. Today, that's down to about 32. For NPR News, I'm Scott Vinn in Charleston, West Virginia.
Bonnie Stewart's book, called Number 9, The 1968 Farmington Mine Disaster, was published in 2011. We'll hear more from Stewart and learn about her book later in this episode. Reporter Michael Klein also spoke with Larry Lane, a federal mine inspector who talked to the electrician who disconnected a fan and then wrote a memo about the fact.
And while I was at Number 9, I found a man who was outside electrician. And on this shift, I was outside in charge. I didn't go inside. I was outside in charge, taking care of the phone calls and notes and everything. And I saw this man that I recognized because I had seen him in Fairmont. That's where I lived at the time. And so I got to talking to him, and he was outside electrician. We were talking about the explosion, and I asked him about the mod run fan when it went down, why nobody knew about it. Because each fan has to have an alarm system, and that alarm has to be stationed where somebody can see it at all times. And he said, well, that alarm has been disconnected. And I said, who disconnected it? He said, me and the chief electrician. I said, why did you do that? And he said, the chief electrician said that that fan kept going down and they were having trouble with it. And every time the fan went down, they didn't want to pull the men out of the mine. So this man told me, he said, the chief electrician said they told him to disconnect the fan alarm system. Said, so we disconnected the fan alarm system.
They told him, meaning?
Pardon?
He said they told him?
He said they, meaning upper management, told the chief electrician, told him to disconnect. That would be your superintendent or mine foreman. And so I wrote a memorandum, and I told exactly what he said, that he had disconnected the fan alarm system. And when the fan stopped, the men are supposed to be withdrawn within 15 minutes. Okay, they disconnected this fan alarm system. So when that fan went down, they didn't withdraw the men. They just let them stay in the mine. They had three other fans, but each fan has a certain area to ventilate. So this area where Mod Run was ventilating wasn't ventilated. And that's what happened. It let the gas build up, and then something exploded. Some ignition caused the explosion.
That was former mine inspector Larry Lane speaking with reporter Michael Klein. Klein interviewed Lane for a book called Truth Be Told, where a transcript of the interview was first published. Klein also sat down with Sarah Kasnowski, who lost her husband in the Farmington mine.
Oh, say, did you see him going early this morning? He passed by your door on his way to the coal. He was tall, he was slender, and his dark eyes so tender. His occupation was mining, West Virginia his home. Oh, what will I say to his poor little children?
I just fell in love with him.
And what will I tell his old mother at home?
Perfect in every way to me. A good husband, a good father, and a good friend. And so, every day goes by, I don't think about him. I have good memories.
To my heart that's clear broken if my darling is gone. Oh, say, did you see him going early this morning?
The memory of November 19th, 1968 is painful for Sarah Kosnowski. She lives at Berwickville, just a few miles down the road from Mannington, where her husband worked the midnight shift at the Number 9 mines.
So
He had worked 45 years in the coal mines since he was a boy of 14, and he knew the danger signs.
My husband worked midnight. And, well, when he came home the last day from work was Sunday morning. Came home about 8 or a little after. And he came home and he says, "Come down here, I want to tell you something." He said, "That mine is going to go." He said, "It's so full of gas and they have a machine covered up." He said, "They're more concerned about the machine than they are the men." And, see, he was fire boss too, see, and he'd take all them readings. When he'd take the readings, why then, they were bad, you know, too much methane. So I said to him, I said, "Pete, don't go to work anymore." I said, "I'll help you. I've helped you before when your strikes, and we'll make it, and I will work. I'm not too proud to work. I love to work." And so he said he'll sleep on it. So then he came up and he went to post office. He couldn't sleep, you know. And then pretty soon he laid down. He got up that evening and I made his evening meal. Then we came in the living room and they was playing "Honey, I Miss You" on this television song. He said, "You know, if you're in the other room, I miss you." I said, "My goodness, Pete, I think about that every day. If you're in the other room, I miss you too. We're just so close." And I said, "When you're outside, I miss you." Because if he'd go down the road to go to post office or go to the grocery store, I'd always run to the den and he would toot his horn and wave down by the road. And I'd look out the window and wave to him. That's how close we were. He's just that good of a guy, I tell you. But anyway, that evening when they was playing that, well, then we made remarks to each other. Then later, well, we both loved to dance. He was really agile. We loved to dance. We could do all the dances. And so we were dancing around here in the living room, too. Played a game of cards, 500 rummy. Then it was getting about 10 o'clock, and he said, "Would I make his bucket, you know, pack his lunch?" And I said, "Peter, you gonna go?" He said, "I have a job to do." So he dressed, and then he said, "Goodbye, I'm going to work." And he kissed me goodbye, and I said, "I love you, Pete. I'll see you in the morning. Be careful." And he went. So then I couldn't sleep very good. I'm always an early riser. I get up sometimes 10 till 6 in the morning. I got up early that morning and I turned on the Today Show. And it told about the tragedy on the television. And I was alone sitting on this davenant right here, the same davenant. And I don't know, I just guess I was in shock, but I ran to the phone. I called my son. I called Pete's brother, lives next door over here. And then I just took out the street screaming.
We read in the paper and the radio tell us to raise our children to be miners as well. Tell them how safe the mines are today, and to be like Daddy, bring home a big pay. Now don't you believe them, my boy, that story's a lie. Remember the disaster at the Mannington mine.
I didn't get to go up to the mines for a few days. because I couldn't walk. Couldn't walk at all. But my young son and my husband's brother, they stayed up there day and night, waiting to see if they could get any sign of life and if they could get him out. Then I'd always dream about Pete. Not a pillow, be soaked. I'd be crying, just sopping wet all my clothes for over a year. And I'd always dream, and he'd always come smiling, and he'd say, I didn't get killed in the mine. I was just away. Then one night I was lying on Davenant, and I was alone. But all at once, just I raised up because something cold just went by me, went, and I looked, and I reached out to feel it. Like a wind, that's the way it was. So I think that was Pete's spirit telling me I'm okay or something.
There is a grave way down in the Mannington mine. There is a grave way down in the Mannington mine. As the flames overtook them in the Mannington mine.
This story was produced by Michael Klein and originally aired on NPR's All Things Considered in November 1992 to commemorate the 24th anniversary of the tragedy. Now, 50 years after the disaster, Miss Kuznowski has passed on. After the break, we'll hear from attorney Tony Opegard, a longtime mine safety advocate. He'll explain how the disaster impacted mine safety in America. We'll also hear from Bonnie Stewart, the author of Number 9, The 1969 Farmington Mine Disaster. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. An explosion rocked the Consol Farmington No. 9 mine 50 years ago, killing 78 men. The disaster also changed mine safety in America. In this episode, we're remembering the disaster. In this segment, attorney Tony Opegard explains the effect the Farmington mine disaster and the 1969 law had on miners.
Well, it was an explosion at the Farmington mine, and 78 miners did die. Not all of their bodies to this day have been retrieved from the mine. I think it's like 19 of the miners are entombed there permanently because the mine was sealed. And it was Consolidation Coal Company, again, you know, a company ignoring basic safety rules that got a bunch of miners killed. And at the time, 1968, I mean, every year there was hundreds of miners who would be killed in the United States. It was not rare. It was just rare to have 78 at one time. And you also had the iconic photo taken by the photographer from the Charleston paper of the giant mushroom cloud outside of the mine that looked like an atomic bomb. And you see the helicopter hovering in the upper right-hand corner of this photo. And I think it was shocking to people. And this was the earlier years of television when those images were on TV and people were shocked and outraged. And it spurred Congress to pass the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969. And I think that explosion and that tragedy was historic and has benefited countless numbers of miners. I would say that literally thousands of miners' lives were saved because of the legislation that came about from the Farmington disaster. And you've heard the expression through the years that all mine safety legislation is written in the blood of miners, and that's really true, that the only time we get legislation is after there's been an explosion that's killed multiple people. Most miners in Appalachia and throughout the United States die one at a time, and no one ever hears about their deaths other than the family members. And, you know, there's no legislation that comes about if a miner is killed because of unsafe conditions in eastern Kentucky today. It's going to be forgotten about a week from today by everybody except for the family members. And I've represented families of miners who were killed underground, and I know firsthand the anguish that people go through and how it affects many, many people for a long period of time. So it has an impact for years and years. I can think of just in the about a year or so ago, I got a message on Facebook from someone, from a young lady whose dad was killed in the South Mountain explosion in Norton, Virginia. And that was in 1991. And I think I had met her once as a young child, and she had written to me about how she still grieved over the loss of her father. Now, this is, say, 2014. It was, 20-some years afterwards, and how she still misses him and all the things she missed out in her life. So what I'm saying is that it has this unimaginable effect on people that you don't understand until you've been through it. And that's how all of the families of the Upper Big Branch miners still feel today. It's been 5 years, 5.5 years, but they still feel the effects of those of the disaster. They're still very passionate about it. What's different about Farmington is something came of the Farmington disaster. You had this major piece of legislation that changed the rules of how mining was done in the United States. And then in 1976, you had the Scotia disaster in Letcher County in eastern Kentucky. And it was March of 76, and there was two separate explosions that were 2 days apart. The first one killed a bunch of miners, and then you had rescue team going underground looking for the bodies, and you had a second explosion which killed a bunch of members of the rescue team. My memory is I think there was 15 miners killed in the first explosion and then 11 mine rescue people, including some federal mine inspectors, in the second explosion. You had these twin explosions that killed 26 miners. And again, that spurred Congress to action, and they held hearings. Representative Carl D. Perkins from Knott County, Kentucky, held a congressional hearing, and Congress passed the Federal Mine Safety and Health Act of 1977. And it strengthened the 69 Act. It put in provisions to protect whistleblowers. These are miners who complain about safety, unsafe conditions underground, or miners who refuse to work in unsafe conditions. That law protected those miners. And those two laws together, the 69 Coal Act and the 77 Mine Act, have saved literally thousands of lives over the years. And our death rates have gone down in America from hundreds of miners in the late 60s down to now. You know, if there's 15 miners killed in a year now, you would think that's a really bad year. And so it has had a tremendous effect. The sad part about Upper Big Branch is that nothing has grown out of Upper Big Branch. Not one piece of meaningful legislation has occurred on a federal level. Some has on state level in Kentucky and in West Virginia to a lesser degree, but nothing from the federal government. And although Upper Big Branch was the worst mine disaster since the Hurricane Creek disaster in 1970, where you had 38 miners killed, It was the worst disaster in 40 years in America, yet Congress didn't have the will to pass meaningful mine safety legislation. And there's certainly major loopholes in the federal mine safety law that need to be closed, a law that needs to be strengthened. And Representative George Miller from California introduced a reform bill, and Senator Byrd from West Virginia introduced a similar version in the Senate, and neither of those bills even got out of committee, never were brought to a vote. And I think that's a shameful commentary on the politicians in Congress at that time.
We read in the paper and the radio tell us to raise our children to be miners as well. Tell them how safe the mines are today.
Nobody at the state or federal level ever tried to file criminal charges against CONSOL for actions relating to the Farmington mine disaster. In Bonnie Stewart's book about the explosion, she points out that in late 1982, the widows of the Farmington disaster reached an agreement with CONSOL and the lawsuit was dismissed. Stewart wrote, "At the time, the federal government had no power to prosecute the company. The state of West Virginia did have the power, but did not use it. Given the sworn testimony taken during the Number 9 hearings and the physical evidence discovered during 9 years of recovery efforts, both the state and federal governments easily could have assigned fault for the disaster. Neither chose to do so." Today, the family members of the 78 miners who died have brought a new lawsuit against Consolidation Coal for the company's involvement in the Farmington mine disaster 50 years ago. In 2014, the families of the miners killed in the Farmington disaster learned that the fan had been turned off. They also found out about Larry Lane's memo written in 1970. Bonnie Stewart found it while researching her book. Based on that new evidence, they brought suit against the coal company. CONSOL argued there was a 2-year statute of limitations and the suit was dismissed. Today, a federal appeals court has asked the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals to help determine if the families can sue. A final decision has not been made. As is the case for so many mining disasters, church leaders were instrumental in helping families during the harrowing days of waiting for news of their loved ones trapped underground. Methodist pastor Reverend Richard Boyer was one of the leaders who was there.
It was a strange and calamitous situation. Everyone was gathered and clustered around the Champion store, the company store.
Boyer is explaining what it was like the day after the Farmington disaster. Families were still waiting for news of their loved ones, and the national media had swarmed into the small town of Farmington. Consolidated Coal Company had transformed the Champion Company store into a makeshift headquarters for the press, the families, and anyone else who wanted to drop in. He says it was pure chaos for the families.
The most striking thing was how aggressive and insensitive so much of the media was. These persons would keep an eye on family members. If they saw someone looking like, and it was almost always women, about to cry or break down or, you know, erupt in some kind of emotional state, they would pounce almost on that situation, stick a microphone up to their face and ask insensitive questions, you know, how does it feel about having your, you know, is it your husband or, you know, but it was very probing and no sense of compassion or concern for the anguish that these persons were feeling.
But not all of the journalists treated the families that way.
Now, I really need to say that this was media from elsewhere. The local media, which was primarily newspaper, they were from the area. They knew something or had some feel. They knew people who were coal miners, may have known some of the families that were involved. These persons were quite sensitive and did not act in these kind of intrusive insensitive kinds of ways. So there was a real distinction between the, quote, external media and the local media in terms of how they dealt with the families.
So then some of the church leaders made the decision to set up another headquarters, mostly for the families to get away from the press. They rearranged the local Methodist church to set up a station with medical supplies, emergency equipment, food, and water. They moved the pews so the clergy could sit with families and comfort them. The Red Cross helped set up areas where people could get some rest.
So we set up some cots where, unfortunately, since I was there 8 days and nights, having cots available to lie down on at least and get a little sleep was helpful.
But not all the families were at the church. Boyer says a lot of the loved ones chose to stay home, including most of the relatives with Catholic faith. Priests would meet them where they were. As the days went by, they organized a new system for news to be announced to the families first, before the press.
But we decided to converse with the company, union, and federal agency to agree that when an announcement was made about the status of things, of the rescue or recovery operations, they would be done first here at the church to the families, and then they would go back up to the company store and release their statement to the media. A major transition in how this was handled. And I think these kind of patterns have developed into be the standard operating procedure at more recent mining disasters. So it's one of the significant things that we were able to facilitate and to accomplish.
Again, that was Reverend Richard Boyer, a Methodist pastor who was present at the time of the Farmington disaster. Thanks to Francine Kirk for recording that audio. Kirk is a professor of communication and theater arts at Fairmont State University and interim director of the Frank and Jane Gaber West Virginia Folklife Center. She also collected this next interview with Bob Campion. When Consolidated Coal's No. 9 mine exploded, killing 78 miners of the 99 who were there working that day, Bob Campion was at school, beginning his student teaching. He had been a freelance photographer for the Fairmont Times since he was 15. The morning of the disaster, Bill Evans, the editor of the newspaper, called Bob and insisted he come to Farmington. He spent the next 10 days at the scene.
There were close to 80-some men in the mine still. At that point in time, realized then that this was no just small incident that was occurring around the mine. This was really something major that had taken place. You could hear this rumbling like a chimney fire as the smoke was pouring out of that shaft. Driving up the hollow, I could see this large plume of smoke in the air. As I got closer to it, the realization of the real magnitude of what was going on hit you. Once I saw the devastation, it was definitely an outward sign that there was real problems in that coal mine.
Bob remembers the reaction of the families as the days went on. Bob says he saw them begin to give up hope. The rapid spread of the fire caused officials to seal the mine 10 days after the explosion.
Families were starting to show up, and they were gathering across the street at the Champion store. Now the state police had gotten there, they had barricaded the drive going down into the main tipple, and there were a lot of families that had started coming to the Champion store, family members and relatives. You could see that they were losing hope. When you look at the whole incident in general, and we say 78 men lost their lives, and that's very tragic. It was. But it wasn't just 78 men that suffered. You know, a community suffered. All the families suffered. You know, children grew up without fathers. Women grew up without their husbands. So it was day 11 when they finally made the announcement that there was no hope and that all of the parties involved, Consol, the federal mine inspectors, state mine inspectors, United Mine Workers, that they were going to seal the mine.
The situation was tragic for the community and West Virginia as a whole. Responding to the disaster, Congress passed the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969. It was a direct result of the Farmington disaster, and it strengthened laws about mining and safety.
So those 78 men accomplished a lot in the fact that they were in somewhat sacrificed to save hundreds or thousands of lives of miners across the nation. But when you think of mining and what the Miner Safety Act was about, it wasn't just coal mining. It was salt mining. It was gold mining. You know, it was limestone. It was any mining that took place in this country. The regulations for those mines were changed. And a lot of people's lives were saved because of what happened in Farmington, West Virginia.
The Consol No. 9 mine was the primary employer in Farmington. The deaths of the miners was a tragic blow, and closing of the mine took the remaining life out of the town.
After the announcement was made that the mine was being sealed, the news media then realized that this event was over, that the next phase would be when they would come back. When Consol felt and the federal mine inspectors, state mine inspectors, United Mine Workers felt that the mine would be safe to send recovery teams in. Life didn't go on the same. And in fact, you know, at one time they had talked about reopening the mine, but that never happened, and the mine was closed. And that was pretty much the heart and soul of Farmington.
Bob Campione spent the rest of his career in the area, but didn't return to journalism. In 2016, though, using his photographs, Campione published the book 1968 Farmington Mine Disaster for Arcadia Press. Other books have been written about the explosion, but one of the more recent ones made national news. Bonnie Stewart was working at WVU as a journalism professor when she started researching the mine disaster. She ultimately wrote a book about what she found called No. 9, The 1968 Farmington Mine Disaster. Families of the mine disaster victims filed a new suit after the book was published, based in part on what her research uncovered. Reporter Molly Bourne spoke with Bonnie before the memorial service for the 50th anniversary.
Why did you decide to write a book on the No. 9 mine disaster?
Like a lot of stories begin, this one started in a bar. I was talking to Vicki Smith, who at that time was an Associated Press reporter. And Associated Press reporters often are working on 2, 3, 4, 5 stories a day and don't have time to do long-term projects. And I asked her, because I knew I needed a long-term project because I was on tenure track at West Virginia University. So I said, Vicki, you know, if there was a story you could do and have unlimited time to do it, what would it be? And she said, I would research the Farmington No. 9 mine disaster. And I said, do you mind if I steal that? And she said, no, go for it. And so I did.
You write in the book that there had been a number of violations at this mine for years and the years leading up to the disaster in 68. And I wonder why those problems persisted.
I think it was the culture of coal mining at the time. In the world of federal regulation, the federal government really had very little control at all. So it was left to the State Department of Mines to monitor the safety in the mines. And when I started working on this, I went to the state archives and pulled out every inspection that had been done on this mine since 1935. And if you followed the course of those inspections, you could see the difference between what was found by different inspectors. There was one inspector, and I don't recall the name, who would go, and his reports were like, there were no problems. Then another inspector would go, and there would be multiple problems found in violations that were found, violations of West Virginia law. There was also another explosion in 1954, and 16 men, I believe, died in that explosion. Had a full shift of men been working, far more people would have died in that. But it was the same problems. Too much gas, too much coal dust, and equipment that wasn't properly maintained.
So in Farmington coverage, we often see the image of the smoke pouring out of the mine. And I was struck by the fact that you featured two miners escaping on the cover of your book. And I wonder why you decided to do that.
To me, those were the most powerful images that existed. Plus, Bob Campione, I discovered worked right across the street from me. So it was pretty amazing that those original photos from the original photographer, who happened to be an intern at the time, gave me permission to use his photos.
My family is from Farmington, and they've told me some of their recollections of the explosion. But I can't imagine what that day was like, and I wonder what are some of the accounts that stuck with you as you were reporting this book.
Well, a couple of them. Joe Magnus sat with me a long time to talk about being at his friend's house and that his family was getting ready to open a gas station the following Saturday. His father was retiring. He was going to be the last person in his family to have to mine coal. And then, of course, that didn't happen. And, you know, he ran home without his shirt on in the middle of winter to watch the TV account and then to go with his family to the mines.
Yeah, that scene that you describe in the book of him, it was like 2 miles, him tearing down the road shirtless, like in the winter. That was really powerful, I thought.
Well, you can imagine it's, and I think I described it as, if you've got a military family and a black car with two guys shows up at your house, it's like that when you get that phone call that there's something wrong at the mine. It's almost like you know there's a death coming behind. Jim Matish was another person that spent time with me and talked about waking up in the middle of the night just about the time that the mine exploded and hearing a voice that was saying, fire in the hole, fire in the hole, fire in the hole. And that the night before, his father had, you know, told him to be good and to be safe and that he loved him. But he had overheard his parents talking about how dangerous the mine was. And his mother had tried to get his dad to stop saying, you know, we can manage, you know, I'm working at the church, we'll figure it out. But he said no, he had a son to educate. And of course, Jim Matish is now a judge. So that did happen.
So you wrote in the book that media coverage of the event, both the explosion itself and the aftermath, emboldened politicians. And I wonder how the news coverage differed with this event.
Well, this was the first time anything like this had been nationally televised. And the crews were there. It was on the nightly news. People across the world could see what had happened and what a tragedy like that looked like.
This disaster is credited with prompting Congress to enact the Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969. And I wonder what sorts of changes did we see with its passage?
Well, for the first time, the federal government, the federal inspectors could actually cite somebody and fine them for the violations. In the past, they could recommend change. And it also required, I forget how many, annual inspections of each mine by the federal government. But it was the beginning of a real federal oversight of for the health and safety of the people who go underground.
The official cause of the explosion itself, it went unexplained for years. And I wonder why that is, and if you could talk a little bit about what you found in your reporting that can help shed some light on what happened.
So, to me, the memo that was uncovered in Beckley that said one of the major ventilation fan alarm systems had been bypassed, so the alarm didn't go off, and that was the fan that went down that morning. Electrician for the company told the inspector, hey, you know, that safety alarm was wired around, it was disabled, and that morning there was no way for anyone to know to come out of the mine. But the memo, when you look at the notations on it, basically, it was, you know, sent to the top brass in the federal government, and they just filed it away with the records, and they wanted this to be done with and go away. The federal government at that time had, you know, no power to do much. And the state didn't even bother to file a report on this disaster, even though by its own law it was required to. Not one fine was ever levied for that disaster. The state had the power to do something and didn't. And the federal government, even when it found out what had happened, turned its head. So it was just a total, in my opinion, a cover-up, or they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to know. They didn't want to acknowledge what really happened.
How did you come across that memo?
It was real weird. I was reading some notes from the attorneys, and there was just a little note in there about a memo. And so I called. I hadn't been down to the Beckley Library yet, so I went down once, and they kind of just gave me the surface stuff. And then I kept looking into who actually had control over those, any other records, and I found Melody Bragg was the librarian who was doing a lot of the archival work. And so I talked to her on the phone. I said, you know, here's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a memo, and I can't find it in any of the records I have. I don't see any mention of it in any official reports except some notes that were taken by the attorneys when they came down to look through the stuff. And so she dug into the boxes. I think there were like 8 boxes that had not been cataloged. And she found it. And she called me and she goes, I think I have your memo.
Wow.
So I packed up my car and I went down there for about a week and Xeroxed everything I could get out of those boxes and the memo, of course. I have boxes of this stuff.
How did you know the memo existed? How did you know to say, Melody, I'm looking for this thing?
It was from the box of records the attorney had given me. He had represented the widows during the first lawsuit that was filed right after the disaster. And they had all these boxes of their work. And there was just a little, you know, one-liner in there about a memo.
So the families filed a lawsuit in 2014. The most recent mm-hmm. one. And I know that, so they are alleging that the head electrician of the mine disabled the safety alarm. And I wonder, like, why is that so much more powerful than just the alarm was disabled by someone?
Well, I believe it would tell you that it was at the company's command, that the company top officials knew that it had been done. I think it had to be ordered by somebody at the top of the food chain and that they knew that they had done so.
We're about ready to go down to the memorial service. It's been 50 years. And I wonder how the disaster still resonates today in your view, and then how it resonates for you personally.
I think when 78 people in a community, as small as we're talking here, lose the heads of households and sons and uncles and brothers, a community is forever changed. And people here don't forget these things. And when you've sat at people's kitchen tables and they've told you their stories, it becomes part of who you are as a reporter, because I take this work very seriously, because I'm not the enemy of the people. I'm the voice of the people. I think it's important to remember these stories, because if people don't tell their stories, and if the powers that be do not understand the toll of their lack of responsibility, things don't change. People don't have to die if everyone's doing his or her job, if the rules are followed, safety comes before productivity and above profit. That's what I would hope people would learn from this accident. It wasn't an accident. I hope this is what people would learn from this tragedy that could have been avoided.
Thank you so much.
In this episode, we revisited the Farmington Mine disaster, a coal mine explosion that killed 78 men. We remembered that it was the widows who insisted that Congress act to protect the lives of American miners, and we reviewed the numbers and heard from experts who said the Coal Act has saved countless lives. On the 50th anniversary, the pain for the widows and children is still stark. I know my family still feels the loss of my father, who died in 2001 at Still Run No. 4 as he worked to restore electricity to the coal mine. Birthdays, holidays, and life just aren't the same. I know my kids would be better humans with my dad in their lives. The laws are meant to provide justice for the people, and I'm no legal expert, but if new evidence surfaces in a murder case, the suspect can be tried, right? This is 78 human lives with 78 families and legacies. It seems the grief would just be beginning to set in after 2 years that the statute of limitations allows for. But if the lesson of this disaster is, as Bonnie Stewart said, that this tragedy could have been avoided, it seems that Congress has taken steps to avoid such disasters in the future. But have we done enough to help the victims' families? You can send us an email with your thoughts to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Ton Breeding, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. A special thanks to Molly Bourne for her work on this show, and to Francine Kirk, who provided us the interview she collected from Reverend Richard Boyer and Bob Campione. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Molly Bourne is our web editor. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org, or send your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget, you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.